Welcome back. I am Melih Razazan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Calories cannot be seen, tasted, smelled, or easily counted, but millions of people track their personal intake of them. In their new book, Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics, authors Marion Nestle and Mal Nesheim go beyond the numbers to explain the importance of calories to public health, social, and economic issues facing the world today. About a million people in the world do not take in enough calories to maintain health and are hungry and malnourished. Another billion or so take in so many that they are overweight or obese and have higher risks of for chronic disease and disability. As a result, in addition to a $1 trillion food industry, the U.S. has a $60 billion diet industry, including thousands of low-calorie diets and processed foods. In Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics, Marion Nestle and Mal Nesheim explain where calories come from and how their perception of them have changed. The ways food marketers and public health officials have tried to use them. Marion Nestle is a consumer activist, best-selling author, and professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at New York University. She writes a monthly Food Matters column for the San Francisco Chronicles and blogs at Food Politics. Nice to have you back, Marion. Really. We are also joined in the studio by Mal Nesheim, who's a professor of nutrition emeritus and provost emeritus at Cornell University. Great to have you on, Professor Nesheim.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And we want to hear from you. What is your understanding of calories? Have you ever counted them? How are your dietary choices influenced by the food industry's marketing of reduced calorie products? Give us a call, 866-798-8255, or drop us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org, or better yet, leave us a comment on the website for everyone to see, yourcallradio.org. So before diving in and speaking about your fantastic book, which I learned quite a bit and did some of the tests that you guys did in finding the where you are in sort of the weight scale, I wanted to get your reaction to New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's recent plan to ban sugary drinks larger than 16 ounces from most restaurants, movie theaters, food carts, and delis. The health board is expected to pass the plan later this year, and it could take effect by next spring. So he has come under attack for promoting, quote-unquote, a nanny state. And on the other hand, he's been praised by some people. In your book, you say that food choices are only partially about personal responsibilities. And much of the conversation here is really about individuals as opposed to the relationship between individual and the state. So what do you see the role of the state to be in regulating what you call the food environment? Marion?
Yeah, the state does regulate the food environment. And what Mayor Bloomberg is trying to do is to do a little tweaking. So instead of regulating the environment so that junk food is the default and it's cheaper than healthier food and easier to get than healthier food, he wants to tweak the environment so it's a little bit easier for people to make more healthful choices. What's so interesting to me about the dispute is the ferocity of opposition when a 16-ounce soft drink is two servings and is already at the limit of recommended amount of sugars in a daily diet.
So 8 ounces is a Coke bottle, right?
Oh, an old Coke bottle. An old one. You can buy 8-ounce cans,
yes, cans
of Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola, but you have to pay more for them than you would if you buy larger ones. So that's an environmental disincentive to eating more healthfully. The smaller ones should be cheaper. than the larger ones, and then people would buy the smaller ones. And there is so much research now that shows that people eat the amount that's in the container. If the container holds 100 calories, they eat 100 calories worth. If it holds 800 calories, they eat 800 calories worth. So his suggestion that 16 ounces be the default is not exactly radical. It's two servings.
So why is he getting so much slack for it? I mean, why is so much attack? I mean, editorials. I mean, Washington Post, New York Times.
The New York Times editorial even opposed it. I think the attack comes from two places. One is that it's an attack on personal freedom. We have a God-given right to eat as much soda as we want. And as if the amount of money that the soda industry puts into convincing people that drinking sodas all day long is normal, and forget about the calories. Most people don't think that sodas have calories. There's research that shows that too. And then some of it is just the idea that the government is tinkering with something that seems so small on its surface. And if this, then what's next?
And what would you add to it, Mal? What do you think there is such attack on it? And do you think this is going to make a dent? This is a positive development.
Well, that's one of the criticisms. People say, well, this is not going to be successful, so therefore it's going to discredit some of these efforts to do some public health solutions to this. But, you know, it's a start. One has to kind of look at the food environment, as we talk about in this book, and see what we can do as to try to make that environment more conducive to being able to eat healthily and to maintain our body weight and so forth. So, you know, I think it's an interesting first step, and I admire the mayor's courage in going ahead and trying to do that.
What I like about it is that it cuts right to the heart of the calorie problem, which is portion sizes. If I had one thing that, or if we had one thing that we could communicate to the public, it's that larger portions have more calories. And what a concept.
And it's interesting that in your book you talk about how sort of 80s, what was that demarcation line in terms of date when everything started to change. Why 80s? What happened in the 1980s that upped the number of calories, which is what, 700 calories per day extra we are consuming now? And
no, we have available now.
They are available now. So what happened in the 80s?
Well, I think there were three things. One was a change in agricultural policy that encouraged farmers to grow as much food as they possibly could in order to get subsidized. Another was a change in the way that Wall Street evaluated corporations from valuing blue chip stocks. You never hear anything about blue chip stocks anymore. Those things that little old ladies used to clip coupons from that gave long, painfully slow returns on investment, but did it for a really long time. And now Wall Street demands that corporations not only make a profit, but grow their profit. And the third was the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, in which an enormous deregulatory movement started in Congress and in the government that just deregulated marketing and all, and those kinds of things put together created a food environment in which food corporations just had to work much harder to sell food, and they were quite good at it.
And we're going to come back to this because I think this is really fascinating information you provide in your book. Mal, let's go back and sort of to the beginning of your book. And you say that people are so confused about calories that you've come to think of them as the C word. Nobody wants to talk about them, and they're poorly understood. And before the show, I did ask a number of people about what calories are. And a lot of people just went back to their thermodynamic classes of their undergraduate years, and they said what it is, it's a unit of energy. But first of all, why are there so much confusion about calories, and what do people really need to know what calories are?
Well, I think that part of the problem is just calories are this so-called C word, and people hear about it all the time. And Marion always likes to talk about her film debut in this film,
Supersize Me,
where Morgan Spurlock went out into the street and asked people what a calorie was, and nobody could give an answer. And so Marion was the star of the show, which showed how they did it.
Even I was rolling my eyes.
Yeah. So it's a concept. It's kind of an abstract concept, and people know about calories. They hear about calories all the time, but without kind of connecting it to quantities of food and the kind of foods they eat and so forth, I think creates a great deal of confusion.
So what do you have to add? I mean, why do people need to know about calories and not about the quality of food that they're consuming?
Well, calories have to do with weight. And it really doesn't matter where the calories come from when it comes to weight alone. And we don't advise counting calories. We advise paying attention to portion size and weighing yourself if you've got a weight problem. It's really the only way to do it. Because you can't, as an individual, count calories in food unless you know exactly how the food was made, how it was put together, where it came from. You have to weigh it to know the exact weight. Larger portions have more calories. And so if you just eat a little bit more of something, then the calorie value that's in a food table isn't going to be accurate. And most people underestimate the calories that they eat by phenomenal percentages, 30 to 40%.
Why?
Because you can't believe that a large portion has as many calories as it does. It's inconceivable. There's something that just boggles the imagination. And the best example I can think of is something that we did at NYU, where a former student of mine, Lisa Young, we asked her, because we were working on this book, we asked her if she would please ask her class how many calories were in an 8-ounce soda and how many calories were in a 64-ounce soda. And she came back and said, and we didn't expect people to know how many calories were in an 8-ounce soda, but we did expect them to multiply by 8.
Yeah.
And she came back and said the average multiplier was 3. Most people thought that if they said there were 100 calories in an 8-ounce soda, that there would be 300 in a 64-ounce soda. We said, go back. You have to ask them, how come? And they just said, because 800 calories in a soda is impossible. You don't see 800 calories on food labels. Nobody tells you that a soda is a third of your daily calorie intake. This is inconceivable.
And you also talk about, which I was very surprised, 500 calories cupcakes?
Oh, easily.
Oh, sure.
Easily. Easily. And those are the unfrosted ones.
Yes, have you? I don't know if you've looked at some old recipe books and so forth, but it used to be that a recipe would be said it's going to serve eight servings, eight people. But now, some of the new books, the same size recipe is supposed to serve 4 or 5, something
or two,
like that.
Or the famous cookie recipe in Joy of Cooking that used to make 40 cookies and now makes 10, a dozen or something
exactly,
like that.
Exactly. I mean, there's a huge increase in portion size that is not only in restaurants, but it's also in home cooking and so forth.
And that's the voice of Mal Nesheim, who's a professor of nutrition emeritus and provost emeritus at Cornell University. And we are joined also in studio by Marion Nessel, a consumer activist, best-selling author, and professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at NYU. Together, they have written this really amazing book called Why Calories Count, from Science to Politics. And we also want to hear from you. Do you count your calories? And have you ever counted them? How are your dietary choices influenced by the food industry's marketing of reduced calorie products? And do you read the labels of food packages you buy? 1-800-1-866-798-8255. You may also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or better yet, leave your comments on our website for everyone to see at yourcallradio.org. So one of our listeners just wanted to know, when you eat something, whether it's, let's say, 50 calories of a bunch of carrots or 50 calories of cupcakes, are calories created equal?
You know, once they're in your body, yes.
Okay.
I mean, it's possible that you're not going to absorb as many calories from a carrot as you are from a cupcake, But the food labels that give the calorie numbers take digestion into account. Mm-hmm.
So take us through that process, because it's really interesting, the step-by-step process, Mal, of how when we eat something, it goes through so many different processes.
Yes, well, food, we estimate the calories in food by just putting it in a calorimeter and burning it. And in a high quantity of oxygen, and the heat comes off, and we can measure how many calories are in that portion of food. But when we eat it, it has to go into our bodies, it has to go into our digestive system, and some of that will not be digested and cannot be absorbed into the body. So we're really talking about the calories in food that we are interested in are those that actually get inside the body from our digestive system. And those are the technical term for those are calories of metabolizable energy, because we can metabolize them.
And they come from protein, fat, and carbohydrate.
They come from protein, fat, and carbohydrate.
And alcohol,
exactly. Yeah. I mean, protein has a calorie value of about 4 calories per gram, as does carbohydrate. And that's after it gets into the body. And fat has about 9 calories per gram. So that's why high-fat diets are considered to be very high-calorie diets. So once it gets into the body, these calories are metabolized in much the same way. I mean, they're used for different purposes, but they're metabolized in much the same way. Protein is metabolized a little less efficiently than fats and carbohydrates.
But we don't eat that much protein.
We don't eat. Why not?
Oh, because foods don't have much protein in them in general.
And they have mostly fat.
Yeah, they're mostly fat and carbohydrate.
And how did this? In your book, you have a system which is basal metabolic rate and also the BMI.
Yeah. Well, when we
which is a measure of how obese you are and at really what is the minimum energy that we need. So how do these numbers work in terms of a healthy person, how much energy do we need to really sustain ourselves? And where are these numbers in terms of where we go from being overweight, normal to overweight to obese?
Well, this gets into the whole question of measurement versus estimation. When calories are measured, you get in the body and in food, you get very, very different numbers than you do if you're trying to guess what they are. BMI, or body mass index, is something that nutritionists and scientists use as a sort of a ballpark figure to indicate when risks for disease start going up. And below a BMI of 18.5 to 24.9 is considered normal. It doesn't raise any risks. Below 18.5 and above 24.9, it does. And the higher your BMI, the higher your risk of developing chronic diseases.
But what about people who have like a higher BMI, but they have a higher bone density?
Yeah, or they have more muscle.
Yeah.
So it's a ballpark figure.
It's a ballpark figure.
It's a ballpark figure. These aren't chemical tables. I mean, they're really not, and they need to be understood. In fact, everything about nutrition needs to be understood as ballpark figures. They're never absolutes. They're always, you always have to leave wiggle room when talking about these things, because people are individuals, and individuals vary.
That's true. And that's Marion Nestle, a consumer activist, best-selling author, and professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at NYU. She writes a monthly column, Matters, for the San Francisco Chronicle and blogs at Food Politics. And also we are joined by Mal Nesheim, who's a professor of nutrition emeritus and provost emeritus at Cornell University. They will be discussing their new book, Why Calories Count, on Friday at 5 p.m. at Book Passage in Corte Madera, and on Saturday, June 9th at 12 p.m. at Book Passage at the Ferry Building in San Francisco. And we have all this information on our website. And we also want to hear from you. What is your relationship with food? What do you think about the regulation and politics behind food labeling and marketing? How are you affected? But what our guests call food environment, which encourages food to eat more often, and larger portions. You may give us a call, 1-866-798-8255. Leave your comments on our website, yourcallradio.org, or drop us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you have full lines, let's go to Ruthann in El Cerrito.
If guests could help, I'm having an impossible time navigating the portion prescription, meaning my physician has commented, as have your guests, is that the key is in portion size. And that becomes difficult when you're looking at food labels for how, I'm looking for some advice on how to more easily navigate that without traveling around the world with a batch of measuring cups and measuring spoons and tape measures and all of that. Is what I'm thinking, when things are already prepackaged, it's kind of easy. You know, one cookie or 10 crackers. You don't have to weigh out the portion. But when you're doing other things, I think I tend to make the mistake a lot of other people do, is when they see lower calories or fat amount, they just see that as the amount and they don't calculate into that the portion size that it's computing that for is for a half a cup. So if you eat a cup and a half, you've tripled it.
Yes.
And I just need some hints on how to better navigate.
Well, can I make a suggestion?
Yes.
I mean, I'm not sure why you're having to do that. This gets us back into the business about estimating and measuring. Since you can't estimate very accurately the number of calories either that you need or that you're actually eating, the best way to monitor how you're doing is to monitor your weight on a scale. Mm-hmm. And if you weigh yourself regularly and your weight's not changing, relax and enjoy it. You're doing everything just fine. If your weight's going up, then you need to cut back and you need to eat less than what you're eating. It's really as simple as that.
But this is about weight, but what about the nutrition?
Oh, well, then we're getting into something else, which is eating better as well as eating less. And eating better means eating fruits and vegetables and grains and a smaller portion so you balance calories, but also eating healthfully. And the thing is that if you eat healthfully, it's much easier to take care of your weight. If you're not eating a lot of junk food, it's easier to manage. Most horrible thing about getting older is that you can't eat as much as you used to. It's such a dirty trick. metabolism slows down. You don't need as many calories. You're in big trouble. And so the only way that I find to do it is to monitor my weight. And I can manage pretty well at home, but it's restaurants that are such a problem.
And we're going to talk about that later. But next, go to Mark in San Francisco. Good morning, Hi. Mark.
Hi.
Hi.
I understand the importance of calories in eating a typical diet, but in my case, I found it possible to maintain a healthy weight, and I'm 49, by having absolutely no processed foods and actually eating mostly raw food. And the side effect of this is that if everyone did this, the food companies would actually go out of business, and we wouldn't have any of these problems at all.
Well, it sounds to me like you're doing just some wonderful things to be able to maintain your weight and eating a healthy diet. And that's just what Marianne was talking about.
You don't even need to count calories if you avoid all processed foods, and that includes things like...
It sure makes it easier.
Well, it makes it easier. I mean, it makes it easier. You certainly can overeat by eating also what we consider healthy foods, but it's much more likely that you're not going to do that. And it's harder to do that because the calories in whole foods are generally not as dense as they are in processed foods.
They have a lot of water.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's Marianne Nessel.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And that's Marianne Nessel and Mal Nesheim, the authors of Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. I am Malihe Razazan. You're listening to Your Call. We'll be back.
You're hearing Your Call on KALW San Francisco, 91.7 FM. KALW has been broadcasting at 91.7 on the FM dial in the Bay Area since 1941. Now, with online listening, KALW has listeners worldwide. But just because you live in the Bay Area doesn't mean KALW's online streams aren't for you. If you hear KALW at work but not at home or lose reception on your commute, check out the online listening options at kalw.org. Whether you're on your desktop, your tablet, or your smartphone, you can stay connected. Just click the Listen Live link at the top of our website, kalw.org.
For those of you joining us now, I am Malihe Razazan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll rebroadcast a conversation Rose Aguilar had with Thomas Lindsay, author of Be the Change, How to Get What You Want in Your Community, and Shannon Biggs, author of The Rights of Nature, How Can Communities Defend Themselves from Corporate Interests? Are local laws the answer? How are they organizing for change in their communities and what changes they have seen? And that's on Thursday on Your Call with Rose Aguilar. And on Friday, it's our weekly media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And if you have any show ideas, you can drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org or give us a call 866-798-8255. Today, we are speaking with Marion Nestle, who's a Paulette Goddard professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and professor of sociology at NYU, and Mal Nesheim, professor of nutrition emeritus and provost emeritus at Cornell University, about their new book, Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. In Why Calories Count, they explain what calories are, how they work, both biologically and politically. They also offer some really candid advice, which we will ask them later. They say human body does a superb job of making sure that it gets enough calories to meet biological needs, but is much less effective at knowing when calories are in excess. So it's much easier to overeat than to stop eating. And we also want to hear from you. What is your understanding of calories? Do you count them? Have you ever counted them? And how are you influenced by the food industry marketing of reduced calorie product, which we consume a lot of? Give us a call, 866-798-8255, or drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org, or better yet, leave us a comment on our website for everyone to see at yourcallradio.org. So, Marion, the calorie that is listed on food packages is based on 2,000 calories a day. And I believe that's what FDA also is regulating. So where does this 2,000 come from?
They made it up.
Really?
I mean, that's a little unfair. If you measure the number of calories that people need on a daily basis, the average American man needs about 3,000 calories a day, and the average American woman about 2,400. These numbers are much, much higher than the numbers that are reported as consumed by people in dietary intake surveys. And they're also quite a bit higher than used to be reported by people in dietary intake surveys when the FDA first started doing the standard for the food label, which came out in 1994. Mm. So already the food label dates back 20 years, almost more than 20 years. At that time, the FDA wanted to use 2,350 calories as the standard for food labels. And everybody said that's impossible. Nobody will be able to do the calculations. We need a rounder number. So they picked 2,000 and everybody went along with it, even though it's lower than most people are actually eating.
Okay, that's very interesting, because you say, I mean, I was actually very surprised that, again, this number was increased in the 80s.
Which number?
The calorie numbers.
That people are eating more calories. Oh, yes. People report eating more calories now than they did in the 1980s. And by every possible measure, it's clear that people are eating more. And that's because starting in the early 1980s, there was so much more food available that it had to be sold. And it wasn't that food companies were trying to figure out how to make people fat. It was that food companies were trying to figure out how to sell their products in an extraordinarily competitive food environment. And so they did that by making portions larger, by putting food absolutely everywhere, vending machines everywhere, eating in bookstores. When did it become okay to eat in bookstores? Some of us can still remember when you weren't allowed to bring food into libraries. Now there's food at Staples. There's food at drugstores. Every drugstore in New York has become a grocery store. It's just bizarre. There's food everywhere, and the research shows the more food that's available, the more calories people eat, and the larger the portions, the more calories people eat. And all this happened without anyone being really aware of it.
And that's the voice of Mary Nissel, professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU. And we are also joined by Mal Nesheim, Professor of Nutrition Emeritus and Provost Emeritus at Cornell University, about their new book, Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. And next, go to the next caller.
Hello?
Yes, Philip in Berkeley. Is that Philip?
Hi.
Good morning, Philip.
Hi. I agree that we need more education, and if we could get... things like fruits and vegetables to be subsidized, we get them cheaper, people would eat more of them more often as a part of their total diet. But I'm against sort of penalizing people, making it a penalty. Instead of making things more expensive, we should be making good things cheaper. I think it's wrong-headed to take a minority of people and say, well, because of this minority, we've got to then penalize the majority. I think that's wrongheaded. I think what we should do, we should be approaching it in terms of education and so on. Take the USDA pyramid. That alone, if we change that alone, that could I think, alter people's habits over time, and that's my approach. I think penalizing people by making certain foods, certain calories more expensive, is a mistake. I think cheap calories are necessary to support, especially the poor. Calories should be cheap, as far as possible, because that's what keeps people alive. I mean, if you want to go talk about, well, let's increase the nutrition of those calories, that's a better issue to go on. I think penalizing people for calories is wrong.
Thank you so much, Philip. Yeah. Something that you both talk
could
about.
Could I comment on that?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, I want to comment on that. Right now, the penalty is on people who want to eat healthily. If you want an 8-ounce soda, you have to pay much more per ounce than you do if you buy a 2-liter soda. And if you look at what's happened to food prices in the United States, and the Department of Commerce measures this, the index price of fruits and vegetables has increased by 40% since 1980, whereas the index price of sodas and snack foods has gone down by 15 to 30%.
Because of the subsidizing
It has to do with the way subsidies work and other kinds of things work in this country. So right now we have a situation in which unhealthy food is subsidized and is cheaper, and we need to change that. I don't see that as a penalty.
Next, go to our next caller, David in Berkeley.
Hi.
Good morning, David.
Good morning. I so much enjoy the frank and authoritative responses of Ms. Nessel about the FDA. I've heard her before in KPFA. My wife is diabetic, level 2 diabetes, and the system that she's used and has been successful has been based on 35 to about 40 carbs per meal, small meals a day. Of course, we're older, as you mentioned, about eating less as you're older during meals. And not eating, you know, seven or eight meals, but just eating four meals a day. That seems to be an easier numeric system to remember than 2,000, which is a big number for the average person. They may not be suffering from some disease. Why not that system? The last caller, of course, I think hit on the qualitative, which is protein. We always look at protein versus the cheap trick that the food industry tries to swap around and give you less protein for serving, but a lot of carb, a lot of salt and hidden bad things. But,
Mal, do you want to take that one?
Well, you know, one of the first line efforts, of course, when one has a type 2 diabetes is to try to control your body weight. And how people do that can vary in many respects. And so I still think that some kind of a calorie target begins to give you the criteria that you can use to try to do that. But as we've said earlier, weigh yourself. Make sure that you are not gaining weight and control your body weight. And if you have been diagnosed, one of the first line things to do with type 2 diabetes is to try to take off some weight. Mm. And so how individuals cope with this is something they're going to have to work out kind of for themselves. But it sounds to me like your wife has been able to work this out. And so I think that's important.
And something else that you both stress is really eating healthy. And the type 2 diabetes that the caller was just talking about, nearly one-third of U.S. children are overweight and obese. And research shows that youth are increasing being diagnosed with 2 diabetes exactly because of the way they are piling up the, you know, calories and the weight. It's because of the junk food and the sugars and all that.
Yeah, it's not that every overweight person gets type 2 diabetes. It raises the risk. It's a risk factor. But if you look at people with type 2 diabetes, roughly 90% are overweight. So the first line of defense is to maintain a healthy weight.
And next, go to Stan in San Francisco. We have full lines.
Hi, yes.
Go ahead, Stan.
Yeah, I was wondering why, if you go to France or if you're interested in food from a more culinary point of view, I mean, they have a patisserie at every other block, and you have the French paradox, you have all the rich foods that they eat. And I know it's changing now, but they were skinny. How did they do it?
Well, they didn't eat between meals. For starters, and therefore they were controlling their calories in ways that they didn't have to think about.
And the other advice that you guys give in your book, it's get moving. And that's what happens in Europe. I was in France a couple of years ago, and I really had to walk. Even to get into the metro, I had to go through thousands of steps to get there.
Oh, it's why people in New York are generally not as heavy as people in a lot of other cities, because they don't have cars. I don't have a car.
So it does make a difference.
And portion sizes are also smaller. I mean, you go to a good French restaurant, you can have some wonderful food, but the portion sizes are not overwhelming.
And they're not giving you enormous bowls of whatever. They're giving you small bowls of whatever.
So, I mean, through these calls that we are getting, there is not a consensus exactly of how we measure things, what calories are, what's a good calorie, what's a bad calorie. So if you want to just go through some myth of what calories are and what they do, what would they be?
Well, I think, I don't know about myths. I think the first thing to understand is that they're in food and they represent energy, and that the more food you eat, the more times you eat, and the larger portions you eat, the more you're going to be taking in. And that if you want to reduce calories, those are the places where you start. We end our book with a bunch of myths that we think are really funny. Calories eaten standing up don't count. If you're on somebody else's plate, they're borrowed calories and they don't count. If you eat your children's food, it doesn't count because it's baby calories. I mean, that kind of thing. We think they're really funny, but they count. And even the ones in alcohol count, alas.
Yeah, and alcohol, it was really fascinating, the section about alcohol, because the regulation, the way FDA, or it's actually it's not regulated by
FDA.
It's not regulated by FDA. So talk about how alcohol is regulated or not regulated, because it depends on the percentage of alcohol, whether it's beer or wine, or it's 40%, 80% proof. So take us through that process of how it
differs. Yeah, I mean, that was one of the great revelations of the book, was the business about calories. We have two chapters on alcohol. One on the measurement of alcohol calories, which is something that was done by Wilbur Atwater in the 1890s. And his work showed very clearly that there are 7 calories per gram of alcohol. It's almost as fattening as fat. And that those calories count exactly the way fat, protein, and carbohydrate calories count, unless you have liver disease.
But they get absorbed 100%.
It gets absorbed, and it's metabolized, and it has that 7 calories per gram. Unfortunately, you can't get rid of that.
You can't get rid of it. And then the other chapters on the labeling of alcohol, because that is regulated by the Treasury Department. Remember Prohibition, when there was Prohibition in the United States, after Prohibition, the regulation of alcohol was turned over to the Treasury Department, and there's a bureau within the Treasury Department that deals with
it's about raising money from taxes on alcohol.
Yeah, it's just like cigarettes. You sell cigarettes because you get a huge amount of money from the taxation on them. So the Treasury Department cares most about taxation. It doesn't care about consumer education, and it's not so interested in having the public truly understand. If the alcohol industry doesn't want to do something, the Treasury Department tends to go along with it if it looks like it's going to reduce sales.
And it's voluntary, basically, unless they...
Oh, unless
it's within the certain percentage of alcohol content,
right?
By volume,
and the rules for beer, wine, and hard liquor are different. They have a completely different sets of rules. And it depends on the percent. If it's wine, it depends on the percent of alcohol. It's almost impossible to keep straight. And if it has less than 7% alcohol by volume, then the FDA regulates it.
Mal, you wanted to add something?
No, I mean, Marianne has pointed out the really great confusion on this. There's been many proposals to put the calories on alcoholic beverages, and it has not been something that the industry has supported, and the FDA or the Treasury Department has gone along with. Mm-hmm. And so, we're left to kind of our own devices and trying to figure out how much we're drinking and how many calories we're drinking.
And let's go to some emails. We have a listener asking, why are so many poor people fat and rich people thin? Mm-hmm. You guys argue that that's not the case anymore.
Oh, I think even rich people are fat these days. But the leading hypothesis is that junk food calories are cheaper than healthy food calories, and that poor people don't have access to healthier foods in many neighborhoods. That's certainly true in New York City, where I live. And that the best example I can think of is if you go to McDonald's with $5, you can buy 5 hamburgers or 1 salad. I think there's something wrong with that picture. And that, again, gets us into federal policy and the fact that the federal government supports the status quo and isn't doing very much to make healthier diets more accessible to the poor.
And another listener says, your guest suggested that not all calories are absorbed due to digestion. How does high fiber, which is also filling, thankfully, affect calorie absorption? Also, are there other benefits calorically to a high fiber diet?
Well, yes, it's true that high fiber diets are not absorbed as well as something like pure starch. But some of that gets absorbed because it gets into your large intestine and bacteria help digest it, and you still get some energy out of fibrous foods. But there are benefits that are also there for high fibrous foods. It helps your digestive system kind of function properly, and it also gives you perhaps more satiety, so that you're not going to eat quite so much. The whole idea of the density of your calories that you take in is somewhat controlled by the fiber content of your food.
And we have another caller that says, we have so many emails and calls, but this is a listener who emailed us and says, how much is a serving? For example, we are supposed to eat 8 servings of veggies a day. So how much broccoli is that? Or carrot? Or how many grapes are a serving? This is the one thing that has driven me crazy for years.
You have to get food measures and get cup measures. A vegetable or fruit serving is half a cup. It's tiny.
It really is.
It's tiny. Yeah. What is that? 5 or 6 grapes at the most would be a serving. Or 3 little stalks of broccoli would fill a half a cup. It's one of the great misunderstandings of this. You're supposed to eat 5 to how many servings a day. People think this is an enormous amount of vegetables, but it's a very small amount.
So, Mel, I'm just curious in terms of, I have some cans and food packages here. And for example, it says half a cup, it's organic kidney beans. Mm-hmm. And it says half a cup serving size and serving per container about 3.5 calories. And calories. And I have bought these before. And it says calories from just one serving is 110. First of all, how many people really do people pay attention?
Some people do, most people don't.
So how useful is the current labeling system in terms of how much information you can get in terms of the nutrients of the food as well as the caloric content?
Well, you have to know how to read them, and the FDA guide to reading food labels is 10 pages long, so it's not intuitively obvious how to do this.
And they're trying to change it.
They're trying to change it now. I don't know whether they're getting anywhere on it. I just read someplace that the Office of Management and Budget is discouraging the FDA from going into this.
There's been a move to try to put the total number of calories in a package as opposed to cutting calories per serving. Mm-hmm. On labels, for example, and that would kind of take away some of the confusion that you described with that can. But you have to read the label to understand that there's a lot of calories in that can.
And some people read them, and you know, if you know how to read them, it's easy to understand. If you don't, it's not. But that can has about 400 calories in it.
Now, in terms of how much, for example, fat per grams, you know, grams of fat or cholesterol or sodium, who decide what these numbers are? Because in your book you say that USDA, because of capacity issues, it really gets the information from either the scientists or the industries itself. Is that true?
Where they get the numbers from that? The numbers are generally these days calculated from the grams of protein, fat, and carbohydrate. You multiply protein and fat and protein and carbohydrate by 4 and fat by 9, and that gives you the calories that are on food labels. But there were food composition studies done by the Department of Agriculture, by the food industry, by whatever, and they are roughly accurate. So they're good enough. You know, they're not perfect, but they're good enough. They're ballpark figures. Anything having to do with calories has to be thought about as a ballpark figure, plus or minus 10 or 20%.
Yes, I mean, there are certain factors that they use for certain foods that take into account digestion, so that not every carbohydrate in every food has 4 calories per gram, for example. It depends upon the type of food that it is, and there's been some corrections for that. So as Marion says, it's probably about as good as we can do.
And that's Mal Nesheim, a professor of nutrition emeritus and provost emeritus at Cornell University, with Marion Nessel, consumer activist, best-selling author. They have written together this fantastic book, Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. And they will be discussing their new book, Why Calories Count, on Friday at 5 p.m. at Book Passage in Corte Madera, and on Saturday, June 9th at 12 p.m. at Book Passage at the Ferry Building in San Francisco. And we have all this information on our website at yourcallradio.org. Next, go to our next caller, Charlotte in San Francisco.
Yes.
Good morning, Charlotte.
Yeah, I'd like to say, first of all, that weight and calories and I have had a running battle my entire life.
So, and how long does it?
And calories do count indeed, and I've been on a zillion weight loss programs through my life, You know what? They never worked. Well, I'd lose a few pounds, and then I couldn't stand it anymore. And I took all these diet books that say, go for breakfast, have your two slices of toast, have your grapefruit, you know, all that kind of garbage, that, you know. And you eat like that, and you want to shoot yourself at the end of the day. So I made a decision about 3.5 months ago. I decided, you know, I really need to get this weight off. And I took the calorie books, and I took all of that, and I stuck them away. And I said, I made a decision. There was the only thing I really eliminated from my diet is I don't really need desserts. I can live without them. That's not a big deal. But I also decided that I eat nothing that isn't absolutely delicious.
Ooh,
I put nothing in my mouth that I absolutely don't like and really enjoy. Because if I do that, then it's just eating to, you know, sort of to stay alive. And that's not good enough because that's not the way you sustain a diet. You don't lose weight that way. And I also decided it's when you eat. And, you know, you don't really need 3 meals a day. And so I sort of learned that I start my day with a good glass of something that I really enjoy, which is carrot juice. So I drink. And so when I get breakfast is my dinner. It is the most important, biggest meal of the day for me. And I eat lots of, and I don't.
Thank you so much, Charlotte. We are unfortunately coming up.
Let's congratulate Charlotte. She's doing great.
So that's the other thing. I just wanted to ask you about the relationship between age and why it becomes more difficult to lose the weight.
Well, we do several things. When we age, after age 50, the amount of calories that it just takes to maintain our bodies goes down about 3% every 10 years or so. So we're it takes less just to keep us alive. And then we also tend to lose a little of our activity. We don't move as much. And so our total caloric requirements go down as we age. And so we have to eat less if we want to maintain our body weight.
Such a dirty trick.
So we're running out of time. I just wanted to quickly ask you, what is your advice to have
very quickly? Eat less, move more, eat better, and get political. Help change the political system so it makes it easier for people to eat more healthfully.
So your solution has a strong social component.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. Thank you. We have to leave it there. We've been speaking to Professors Mary Nessel and Mal Nesheim, the authors of the new book, Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. They will be speaking in San Francisco this Friday and Saturday. You can check our website for more information. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for all your calls and emails. Sorry we could not get to all of them. I am Malihe Razazan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and here is what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, we'll bring back a conversation Rose Aguilar had with Thomas Lindsay, author of Be the Change, How to Get What You Want in Your Community, and Shannon Biggs, author of The Rights of Nature, How Can Communities Defend Themselves from Corporate Interests? Are Local Laws the Answer? How are ordinary citizens organizing for change in their community, and what changes are they seeing? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our daily podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Eric Jansen is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.